couple of announcements before we begin. I know that we are going to have a couple of cancellations coming up. Thanksgiving Day, the 24th, there will be no class. That's on a Thursday, of course. So that day we won't have class, and Jesus' birthday. The 25th of December, we won't have class, and not because we don't need to have it necessarily, just that if people want to do things for the holidays and all of that, I figure that's the day they do probably want to spend with family. So if you're inclined to do that, you'll have a day off that day. You can sleep in if you're not inclined to. And also, Rich had sent out a deal for a church-wide dinner on the 19th. If you have not responded to that, please respond one way or the other. We don't care if you come. But we don't, need to know. So, we do care if you come. We'd like everybody to come because we love everybody. And we do. And so, that, and also, if you know of dates that you're going to be off, like you're taking extended time off, this time of year I usually ask for like schedules so I can coordinate when the maximum number of people are gone. That's when I will take my time off. If you know for a fact you're going to be gone any length of time, even if it's just a few days, if you'll just drop me a quick email and let me know. If I don't hear from you, I'll conclude that you're going to be here every Bible class. So, other than that, but if you know you're going to be out of town or something and you know you've got time off scheduled through maybe the first of the year, it's really, really all I need, because this time of year tends to be more out of season. People are more out of pocket and all of that. So let's move on here. Let's continue to make sure you're in fellowship first, of course. If somebody got you out, if it was me, then rebound. We're dealing here with the wife's basic responsibility is to love her husband. And this involves certain things in the dress code, in the behavior code, the adornment is supposed to be. And that's why they supply the word in verse 3 merely, because he says, your adornment must not be external, but it is to be. They've supplied let it be here, but it is to be. It actually would be more of an apparent imperative force rather than a optative or prayer force. But it must be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit. Which is precious in the sight of God. For in this way, in former times, the holy women also, who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves. How did they adorn themselves? Not by the way they dressed. Not with inappropriate clothing. Not with excessive clothing. Not with excessive hairdos. Not, again, try to keep your life as simple as you can. But this is valuable advice for any believer. Keep it simple, stupid. The old acronym. Don't complicate your niche. If you don't have to complicate it, don't. Given a choice between making it more difficult and leaving it alone, leave it alone. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. There's a lot, I could throw a lot of aphorisms at this and just still, it makes you puke. Sarah, just as Sarah did. So that's how you adorn yourself. This is what makes for an attractive woman. Not how she looks, overtly. I mean, not that there isn't, obviously you have one of the things here, we get our word cosmetics from the adornment factor, cosmeo. The verb. So there's a place for all of that. But it's not the be-all and end-all of life. You know, they showed these women on TV. I was watching a deal the other day. I don't know if Julie Bowen has a line on her face. And yet she's advertising this stuff that makes lines go away. Well, she didn't have any to start with, probably. And so, some of this is misleading and deceptive. Oh, this will fix you up. This will make you'll lose 20 years. You're not going to lose 20 years off your face. Come on. And if you want to pursue it with plastic surgery, that's dumber still. And because I see some of these women that have had plastic surgery, and I mean, some of these weird housewives. I don't ever watch the shows, but I just see enough of the commercials that they do. Sign of the cross and run the opposite direction. And they've convinced women you get a chemical peel, it'll take 10 years off of your life. No, it won't. It'll just make your face real red for a while. And you may get some fresh growth of skin. It may be slightly newer, obviously, but if you burn off enough of it, you can get new skin anyway. We can do that with a match at break. We'll just fix it. I'm kidding. We won't. But again, Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. Again, not overtly. She did this in her heart. This is why it's so important. If you're doing it in your heart, it'll manifest itself overtly. But if you're not doing it in your heart, it'll likewise manifest itself overtly. You can't hide certain behaviors. Some men's sins are obvious. So are some women's. And the fact is, other people's, their sins are a little more hidden. But the fact is, we still need to deal with them. So, and you have become her daughters, her children, if you do what is right, without being frightened by any fear. Well, A, the highest expression of love is to become her husband's friend, which will enable her to submit to his authority, even under the most extreme of circumstances. B, generally women begin the marriage relationship as the more flexible of the partners. However, the real danger is that failure to consistently love her husband can cause her to become contentious. This was, in fact, Sarai. That's what the word means. Sarai means contentious, bitchy. And this is one of the things you have to watch out for as a woman. One, again, contentious, one who provokes, enjoys, or constantly argues. How do you know if you're contentious? How do you know if you're horsey? You're arguing all the time. Whatever anybody says, you argue with it. That's one of the ways you can tell. Argumentative spirit is part of that. But that's not attractive in anyone. Certainly not women, but not in anyone, really. They just take the opposite. There are people that will just take the opposite point of view just to do it. They don't call it being the devil's advocate for nothing. It is a part of satanic doctrine to get people into this word battles and all of this, because this gets them off of the important things in life, for one thing. So Proverbs 21:9. So again, I think any time we go over this stuff, we all get a fair dose of places we could improve. Nobody probably gets away scot-free. If you're a perfect husband or a perfect wife, well, good for you. You probably are fouling up our church, because the rest of us aren't. You might raise the IQ here, the spiritual IQ. Well, it's better to live in a corner of a roof. And then you got to really appreciate this living in Florida in the summertime. Get up there and sit on the insulation in the corner of the roof where it's typically going to be 140, 150 degrees. Unpleasant. Then in a house shared with a contentious, gripey, argumentative woman. And the same thing's true. You can also substitute the word here, man. You're better off, women, without a guy that's not like this. Again, as a woman, you can't change him, and he can't change you. That's another thing in marriage. You can only work on yourself. You can say, well, Ron, I want you to fix my husband. Or I want you to fix my wife. I can't fix him. First, I don't have the manual, and I don't have the mandate, you can only work on yourself. So be a better wife. Maybe that's part of his problem. You're not a good enough wife. Do you ever think of that? Or maybe you want your wife to be a better wife. Maybe you're not a very good husband. So you have to consider these things and think about them and put them into play. And this is where the rubber meets the road. Again, it's not talking about these things or knowing them. It's doing them on a day-to-day basis. Because the inevitable monotony of life sets in. I mean, everybody thinks they get married, and oh, it's wonderful, and oh, it's always going to be this way. I found my prince charming, and again, he turns out to be an ogre. And you can kiss him forever, and he may not turn into a prince. So you just have to, okay, well, all right, I'm into this, and I know the doctrine, and I'm going to do the right things as much as I possibly can. 21:19 also, it is better to live in a desert land than with a contentious and vexing woman. And if you don't know what to vex is, look it up. That's a good word. And also 27:15, probably along the same lines, I suspect these are all. A constant dripping on a day of steady rain, Chinese water torture, and a contentious woman are alike. He who would restrain her restrains the wind. How are you going to stop the wind? Grab it, tie it up? What are you going to do with it? You can't. And grasp soil with his right hand. It'll just run out of your hand. That's all it's going to do. Again, the contentious woman has to learn to restrain herself. That's the real issue. That's the real issue. The gripey, whiny, complainy, everything's always wrong woman. But again, there are men that are like this too, so don't just assume it's all only women. See, note that Sarai, one who strives or contentious, argumentative, began her life as a noisy, pushy, domineering woman and grew into a princess, a great woman of God. That's what Sarah means. Sarah means princess. Sarai means bitchy. So you wonder why, what were her parents thinking when they named her? But very often names, kind of have a bit of a prophetic implication with them sometimes. The Bible certainly recognized that. Who demonstrated her willing submission to Abraham. Genesis 17, 15. So there's always hope, as long as you're alive and you got doctrine and you got the opportunity to grow. As for Sarai, contentious, your wife, you shall not call her name contentious. But Sarah, princess, shall be her name. And why? Well, because she's going to, like Abraham's the father of many nations, she's the mother of many nations. If you want to be the king of your castle, well, you've got to treat your wife like she's the queen. She's not the court jester. She's not one of your servants. She's the queen. And so you have to work on that as men. Also, you can see 18:12, and we just read the 1 Peter 3, 5, and 6. 18:12 actually is, you can look at that, we're right here. It's where Sarah does this mentally. And Sarah laughed to herself. Of course, now Sarah's questioning, she's demonstrating some unbelief here about this idea of this promised son. Of course, Abraham, as we know, we saw this in Romans, he faith rested this test for almost 25 years. See, how long did God put me under a test? Don't tempt him. It can be a long time. He was tested on this thing for 25 years and continued to faith rest it. And Sarah laughed to herself because she didn't believe it. And saying, after I have become old, shall I have pleasure of my Lord being old also? And here, this is what she's thinking mentally. She's thinking of Abraham as her Lord, her boss, her master, and her authority. And this is what the 1 Peter passage is about, where she called him Lord. She didn't say it out loud. God calls her on her unbelief, but commends her on her orientation to authority, to her husband's authority. So both the husband and the wife must recognize that the Word of God never sanctions the breaking of the marriage vow. You can't find a verse that commands it, because there aren't any. You can find verses that permit it, but only under a couple of circumstances. Death is one of them. Abandonment is the other one. And adultery is an optional one. You may or may not. You don't have to divorce because of adultery, but you at least have the out. You're okay before God if you do. If the unbeliever or even a believer abandons you and runs off, it's not your job to try to make them stay. You say, they're supposed to honor the marriage vows. You can't make them. And again, you can only work on yourself as a believer. Doesn't matter what the other person does. Divorce is normally not a biblical option. Again, a couple of exceptions. Matthew, we will look at. And some have wrongly called it, what is 1 Corinthians, they wrongly called it the Pauline privilege. And they read into this that you can separate but not divorce. That is not what Paul's teaching there. Paul is not teaching that separation is an option in marriage. And by the way, you can't do it in Florida because it's not legal. It's not recognized. It's not a part of the law. So you can say, I can justify it because of what Paul says. Actually, when read carefully, no, you can't. And the Pharisees, of course, are testing Jesus. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all? And Jesus points them right back to original creation and says, what was God's original design? What's the original intent as revealed in Adam and Eve? And he made them male and female. He didn't make them male and male. Didn't make them female and female. He made them male and female. And for this reason, marriage, again, I haven't found another reason in the Scripture that says why you should ever leave home. Because the home is the authority. It's not to say that people don't do it. But the fact is, marriage is the way out of your parents' house. The legitimate way out. A man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. And the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. And then they said, why did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? And he said, because of the hardness of your heart. Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, and he points back to the original creation, he said it was not this way. This was not God's intention. And I say to you that whoever divorces his wife, except for immorality, and marries another woman, commits adultery. And the disciples typically don't get it and overreact. The disciple said, if the relationship of the man with his wife is like this, it's better not to marry. I mean, if I'm stuck with this woman forever, I don't want to go into marriage thinking that. Well, then why would you get married in the first place? What do you think it is? A merry-go-round? You just pick a different horse every time something comes around? I don't like this one anymore. This one's getting older. You know? And they were very liberal in their divorce policies, of course, among the Sadducees. If she burned dinner, that was grounds for divorce. You know? And while getting served burned dinner isn't fun, it's frustrating, you can't just toss her out of the house for that. And so they applied the most liberal policies, and Jesus applied the most stringent of policies when it came to marriage. And 1 Corinthians also 7. Again, this is one that many appeal to because they haven't really studied it. Or if they have studied it, they botched it up. Because when you go through this carefully, he said to the married, I give instructions. Not I, but the Lord. Now, what is the directive? What is the prime directive here? The wife should not leave her husband. That's it. But if she does leave, she must remain unmarried or be reconciled. Those are her only two outs. And that the husband should not divorce his wife. These are the prime directives. Don't leave. And some have said, well, she can separate and all of that. Well, it doesn't say. First, it doesn't use the word separate here. And the words, he said, if she does leave, that is a word that's commonly used for divorce. It's not used for separation. It's used for divorce. So essentially, if she does divorce him, she's stuck for the rest of her life. You have to recognize that when God put marriage up here, he said, fine, if you divorce, biblically, you're stuck single for the rest of your life. That is God's directive will. Now, I would like to tell you it's not that stringent. That would be wrong. It is that stringent. And we have to enforce this policies. As believers, we have to stand up for these things. This is why the local church is the pillar and support of the truth. We'll stand up for this where the cosmos won't. They'll tell you, no, 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 you got a lot of outs. You got a lot of options. You don't. So if she does leave, again, that is a word very often. Afiemi means to leave in terms of depart permanently. So to the rest I say, not the Lord. So is Paul here saying, well, okay, here's my opinion, but it's not the same as the Lord's? Well, first, it's in Scripture, so it's inspired by the Holy Spirit. But Paul says that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband, and he consents to live with her, she must not send her husband away. And this is very straightforward. This isn't Paul saying, oh, well, you can separate. It's saying just the opposite, in fact. He's reinforcing exactly what Jesus taught on this matter. And so, a part of love is that you recognize when you sign up permanently. And you're not free to just pick and choose and, oh, well, I failed. And see, this is where this idea of, well, I'll just sin and rebound. There's nothing in the Bible that promotes that attitude. There's nothing I've ever seen that says, well, just do what you want to and then rebound and you'll be okay. There are ramifications attached to these things. There are consequences to these actions. People may not see the consequences immediately. They may be years in the coming, but they'll come. They'll get there. And, of course, one of the consequences of this easy marriage and divorce business is look what it does to the children. Look how they suffer under this. And then look what they grow up believing is normal. We got a whole generation that thinks it's normal to be divorced. It's not normal. I mean, we have it. We recognize that there's grace and mercy after divorce. We're not saying that. Some people want to make it like the Fundies. They'll make it the worst sin ever. If you've divorced, you've committed the worst sin ever. You're done. God's done with you. Well, that's an extreme position that the Bible doesn't support that I see. I don't see this being supported. So there, many of the Fundies, they won't let you be a pastor. You can't be a pastor if you've been divorced. You can't be a deacon. You can't serve in certain capacities. You can't do certain things because you are divorced. So you got this stigma attached to you. that we're not going to, in a doctrinal church, we're not going to put a stigma on this. People fail. That's the big deal. Okay, so they failed. What are we going to do? Shoot them. Again, we're the only organization that shoots its wounded. Most of the time, they're trying to carry them off the battlefield. They're trying to save them. But we just say, well, they failed. Bam. Got to put them down. No, we don't want to do that. The goal is restoration. The goal is redemption. It's not killing them or getting rid of them. So that all is nonsense. But we still have to hold to the high standards here. We can't look the other way and say, well, a divorce doesn't matter. Of course it matters. I mean, of course it matters. It matters a whole lot to God. So all this wouldn't be in there. Well, B7 here, it is permitted under only two circumstances, and in neither case it is commanded. The case of immorality, 19:9, we saw that, Matthew, and the case of an unbeliever abandoning a believer. And I could even say there with that, as a corollary, a believer could abandon a believer and run off too. And you're not obligated to try to win them back. If they go off and they divorce you, that's their deal. You can't stop them. So there's a third one that I didn't put in here because I think it's just common sense. And that if they die, you're off the hook. If they're dead, it's over. But see, Paul used that analogy in Romans 7 there. A wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives. Or a husband is bound to his wife as long as she lives. If they die, then you're free from the marriage bond. And then you can legitimately go get married, remarried, whatever you want to do. But again, only to believers. You're not free to go marry unbelievers. We're never going to teach that that's okay. It's not okay. Well, 8, category 2 love includes parental love for children. A, natural affection between the parent and child is expected in a normal home. This must, by biblical definition, also include the concept of normal loving discipline. Titus 2:4 we saw, but Hebrews 12:7. And when we talk about normal loving discipline, we're not talking about abuse. We're not talking about excessive punishments. We're not talking about anything other than what is normally expected. It has been normally expected feature of every culture since time has begun. That this is a normally understood feature of every normal culture. Hebrews 12:7. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? This question presupposes that in all normal families, fathers discipline their children. That this is the job. And a family that is as a product, say, of divorce or remarriage, that's not changed, by the way. This business of people saying, well, we got married, I got divorced, or he got divorced, or whatever it was, and we got remarried, and you're not going to discipline my kids. Oh, you're completely so far out of line there, it's not even funny. You have undermined everything in the marriage that's going to, and those children, with that kind of attitude. I spelled that. I understood that as an unbeliever, people. As an unbeliever, when Linda and I got married, I said, you know, well, the kids, you know, I'm going to discipline if they act up, you know. And Linda didn't fight it. She was oriented to that principle as well. If they come into the marriage, the husband's still the guy in charge. That's where the buck stops. We were talking about that a little on break. If men let themselves be emasculated, whose fault's that? If men refuse to take their rightful authority and use it, whose fault's that? Say, well, my wife makes it difficult on me. I don't care. Grow up. Stand up. Stand your ground. God's given you authority. Use it rightly. And again, this is not for abuse or being a tyrant or any of those things. We're talking about using authority as it's designed to be used. And the proper use of authority is good. That's one of the things he's going to say in chapter 13. The proper use of authority tends towards good. It doesn't tend towards evil. Or abuse, or any of these other factors. So that was spelled out pretty early on in our home. And he says, we had earthly fathers, verse 9, to discipline us. Paul talks about like it's the normal, well, it's not Paul, it's Luke, but he talks about this and writes about it like it's the normal course of human events. That everybody understands this. Well, they should. But again, we've undermined a lot of this in our culture and allowed it to be eroded away. And now what do we have? We have teenagers who can't function. We have people who are not committed to doctrine, not committed to the truth, because the principles of doctrine aren't enforced on them. They're free to come and go as they please and do their own little thing. And yet the parents say, well, I'm going to put doctrine first, but I'm not going to make my kid do it. Well, that's wrong. That's absolutely wrong. If they're under the authority of the household, then they go by the same rules we go by. And that was spelled out again when we started on sound doctrine back in the early 80s. That we're going to Bible class. You can't do things that interfere with Bible class. If you want to be in different activities or do this or that, find something that doesn't interfere with Bible class. And sure, you can go do it if you want to. Some school activity or whatever, some hobby, some discipline, some extracurricular activity. That's fine. And we enforced it. And I mean, I wasn't a legalistic idiot about it. Like, we would take the kids out of school to take them skiing, because ski season's right in the middle of school year. So it wasn't as though they never got to do anything or were abused. Well, don't ask some of them, but, you know. But I remember they enjoyed a lot of this stuff. You know, in the summertime, we'd go camping. We went up to Wisconsin and stayed with some friends up there and out on a lake. And that's women's favorite stuff, camping. Linda loved it. Not so much. But we did it. We didn't go take them fishing and do stuff. It wasn't as though it was a horrible household to live in. Again, depends on your perspective, I suppose. But from a biblical standpoint, you know, no, you don't interfere with Bible class. But yeah, the week we go skiing, yeah, I'll take you out of school. And we were in a real legalistic, fundy school, and they didn't, you know, you just didn't tell them. Man, the kid's sick. The kid's just sick this week. I don't know. Came down with a case of frostbite. It was real cold up there. I didn't tell them. So, again, normal loving discipline is the norm. This is what we should expect. And again, letting the kid go do their own thing in the disregard of doctrines is not helping them. It is not helping them. It is sending them all the wrong signals. It's saying basically, well, God's important, but not that important. You can blow him off if you want to, because it really doesn't matter to us. And that's the wrong signal to be sending to a child. So, be while the Bible commands that children are to be respectful and obedient to their parents. Again, such is not always the case. Children have these commands, obey your parents. But they don't always do that. Any authority is going to find out that those under their authority will test the limits and the boundaries of that authority to see if you mean business. And if you don't enforce it, and enforce it consistently. And like if you have multiple kids involved and across the board evenly, can't enforce it on one child and let the other child do what they want. It's got to be done fairly and even-handedly. So those two verses there, Ephesians 6:1, Colossians 3:20, says, children, obey your parents in the Lord. For this is the right thing, Paul says. See, in such cases of disobedience, natural affections and emotional considerations need to be overruled. And both parents are required to administer consistent discipline, which must be on very early in the child's life. Proverbs 13:24, which must begin, rather, very early on. This has to, by the time they're teenagers, you've lost them if you haven't disciplined them by then. They're going to grow up and be little laws to themselves. That's all we need, more of those out there. Again, I've never been a big advocate, but watching some of the things I've seen, forced sterilization might not be a bad idea. Now, we're not going to endorse that, of course. I'm being somewhat facetious. But seriously, watching some of these people who are claimed to be parents, they couldn't parent their way out of a paper bag. And they don't know the rules of parenting. They don't enforce them. They're not loving. They're not consistent. They don't engage in discipline. And you raise your children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. It's very telling to me that discipline comes first in that chain there. And you've got to have the instruction of the Lord in there as well. Instruction about the Lord, plan of God, what we're expected to do. But discipline's a part of that. Proverbs 13:24. Well, verse 1's a good one. A wise son accepts his father's discipline. It's a fool that rejects discipline from their parents. This is what children need to be told. I don't care how old they are. If you reject discipline and this good advice I'm giving you, you're a fool. And if you want to go live your life as a fool, I can't stop you. But I want something better than that for you. And the parent that won't do this, well, they're essentially condemning their child to a life of stupidity. Why wouldn't you do this? This is a part of what love is. Proverbs 13:24, he who withholds his rod hates his son. And again, the rod being a figure of corporal punishment. This doesn't mean you get an iron rod and beat him. We're not talking about that. And really, the discipline depends upon the age of the child, the nature of the offense, and a bunch of stuff. But I remember when I was young, you know, at first I got in trouble for running my mouth a little too much, and I had to write 500 times. I can't remember what it was. I will not do such and such. I don't remember what it was now. I was only about 6 or 7. I remember this. My dad was disciplining me regularly at 6 or 7. And I remember getting spankings by the time I was old enough. You know, when I was old enough to know the difference between right and wrong, and I did wrong, I got disciplined. And that's healthy. Because I didn't grow up thinking, oh, I can get away with this. And then I go to school and try it, and it doesn't work there, does it? You're not going to run over them. So the parent, corporal discipline is appropriate sometimes. And, if I was outside and acting up, Dad didn't have his bell with me. I remember a couple of times I got switched with a willow switch. Those little things hurt. And I mean, they'll draw blood. They don't do any permanent damage. It wasn't like he wrapped it around my neck and choked me with it. But normally it would be the belt. And you'd hear that belt coming out and you'd know. And that ought to strike fear. See, punishment strikes fear into people. And yet people say, no, it doesn't have any impact. Yes, it does. Weren't you a kid once? When Dad went to get the belt, didn't you worry about it a little bit? Didn't you think right then, I want to clean up my act? I remember that's what my dad asked me. When are you going to obey me? Now! I'm going to now! I've learned my lesson. Please don't spank me. Well, the little reinforcement of the discipline made that lesson stick a little longer. And you'd go through these periods in the household where the kids would gradually, they'd start pushing the boundaries, pushing it. And then finally they'll do something, they'll blow up, and there's this tension in the house, and then after the spanking, it's all gone. There's peace again. The peaceful fruit of righteousness. Luke talks about that in Hebrews. Discipline yields peaceful fruit. You think, well, that doesn't seem right to me, that spanking a child would bring peace. It does. When the child's acting up, it does bring peace. And again, when we had, a few months, or I guess a month or so, maybe back, whenever it was, we had a little meeting about the child care and all of that. And, I just told them straight out, you better obey those people. I got authority from God, and those people got authority from me. You disobey them, you're disobeying me. And if you disobey me, they're going to come, and they're going to get me out of Bible class. And your parent. God help you. And so, what am I going to do? Am I going to go over there and discipline? No. That's a bluff a little bit. But you have to have that fear in the child. They need fear. Children are stupid. I mean, good Lord, the Bible is so plain on this. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. How do you get rid of it? The rod of discipline. We'll get it. We'll remove it from his heart. So somehow, there's a connection between here and here. And the heart is connected to the rear end. And that's where you discipline a child. They're made with this fleshy part of the body. You don't beat them with coat hangers. No more wire coat hangers, You don't do that. You're not abusive. And again, depending on the age of the child, if they're young, a swat with a hand will do it. And sometimes just raising your voice to a sensitive child will do it. You can just tell them, stop right there. I remember when Laura was little, she just burst into tears sometimes. And she'd back off. But, as she will tell you, she grew up, she said, well, I just watched Michael and learned what not to do. And nothing like a negative example. Oh, well, that doesn't work. I'll remember not to try that then. So, but again, even watching another child get disciplined, it's a deterrent. It's a deterrent even to the child that's not being disciplined. And what happens? Matter of fact, when Laura was here visiting this last week or week before, she was telling us about there's this one kid who's physically, I don't know how old the kid is. He's a 4 or 5 year olds, I guess. This kid's physically punching her, biting her, hitting her. And they let this go on in public situations. And I just said, boy, it's not the way I'd run my school. That little brat only pulled that about once. And he'd either be disciplined or he'd removed. But what happened? The other children saw this and they began to do it.
Oh, well, you can hit Laura and get away with it. You can hit the teacher. You can smart off to her. You can do what you want. He gets away with it. We can too. And it sends a wrong signal to allow this stuff. And you see it play out in real life, and it's not pretty. And the children don't grow up learning anything because they don't have any discipline. So if you withhold your rod, you hate your son. I don't care what you say. No, I don't spank him because I love him. You're a liar. You are at odds with the Bible. The Bible says you're a liar. That is not love. But see, this is a biblical definition of love. Not the maudlin sentimentality that passes off in the cosmos as love. That is not love. And I'm glad, I'm really grateful. Well, I didn't appreciate it at the time. I'm really grateful I had parents that disciplined me. And mom never had to do it much, because as the boys get older, it's harder for the woman to discipline them and all that. But she did. I remember getting my, you know, I told her once, I'd said something, some curse word, I don't remember. I was, again, I was about 6 or 7. And I said something, and she says, I told you to stop saying that. She said, if you say it again, I'm going to wash your mouth out with soap. I told her, you're not big enough. She was big enough. Nothing like the taste of soap. And you know what, though? I didn't do that again. You say, well, that, you'd go to jail for that today. You shouldn't. A child wants to challenge you like that? Oh. And can you imagine how bad I would have been if this all went unchecked? I'd have probably been a psychotic killer or something. You know? A psychopathic maniac, a sociopath that runs around doing whatever they want. Nobody ever checks the little sin nature. Oh, yeah. Well, my parents did, and I'm grateful now. I look back and I think, wow, they did, really did good. And these people had no doctrine. No doctrine. I don't even know if they were believers. Now, they all say they are, but I mean, I don't know. We weren't ever encouraged to church or any of that. They would send me when I was little, but not very long. So again, this is normal discipline. The Hebrew in there, verse 24, he who loves him disciplines him diligently. The word there, diligently, has the idea of early or regularly. And it has a nuance of early in life, that you don't wait. You can see the little sin nature acting up in 2-year-olds. Why do you think we have this expression, you're acting like a 2-year-old? Because we know how they can be. You say, well, that's too young to discipline a child. No, it's not. It's not. Abuse is always wrong. It doesn't matter what age they are. But no, it's not. 2- and 3-year-olds have some sense of right and wrong in their life already. They've got a developing conscience. And you're either going to reinforce this conscience in the right ways, or you're going to undermine it by letting them get away with murder. And what it starts out with, they get away with this or that, challenging mom. But that's what, and then of course, dad finally just said, all right, you keep messing with your mom. You'll just tell me when I get home. And those are the words you really hate, to wait till your dad gets home. Because you knew she was going to tell him. And I knew when he got home, I was going to be in trouble. I remember I was acting up at school one day. I was in about 6th grade. I think I was about 11 at that time. Because I started school early. I started like when I was 5. I was in 1st grade. So I was like a year behind most of the kids because they were like a year older than me in the same grade. I remember I acted up and did something, and I got a SWAT. Teachers ought to be able to give SWATs. I'm still in favor of that. And I got a SWAT from the teacher, and then I was sent to the principal's office, and then the principal gave me a SWAT. Well, guess what? My dad found out, and he gave me some too. But you know what? I didn't act up in that teacher's room again. But I thought it was all cute. You know, I was so smart. I knew it all. 6th grade, 11 years old, and you think you know it all. That's children. That's why foolishness is bound up in their heart. I was not an abnormal child. There may be children that were better than me. They may have been more worried about discipline or whatever. But that same stupidity is in their hearts too. Whether it ever acts out or not. Well, D, consistent verbal instruction, coupled with physical discipline as needed, is the standard espoused by the Word of God. Deuteronomy 6, and again, all throughout it, not just in a few places. Deuteronomy 6, 6 and 7. The importance of doctrinal instruction
This is why you can't have them in Bible class too often, to have these principles reinforced over and over again. This is why we supplement with prep school. But the primary responsibility is the parents. These words which I am commanding you today will be on your heart, that you teach them diligently to your sons. And you will talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. In other words, all the time. There's always teaching opportunities. People talk about, well, this is a teaching moment. They're all teaching moments. If you know how to look at them and you understand what's going on. You know, you can be take the kids out to a movie. You see that? Well, we don't do that. Why? Do you think about why we don't live that way or act that way? You know, you can reinforce these things. All the time, there's opportunities. No, you're not going to do that. No. Period. And I'm not going to argue with you about it. And then most people who are selfish and self-centered, little sociopaths, are going to keep at you until they get their way. And that's where, as a parent, you got to learn to be tough. You're not going to keep at me. I'm going to tell you once, and that's it. And beyond all that, you're setting them up for failure. If you let them come at you 3, 4, 5, 10 times on the same thing. I said no, I mean no. We ought to have a parent's deal on that. No means no. We enforce it in the sexual realm, don't we? No means no. We should enforce it in the parent-child relationship. No means no. And that doesn't mean go around behind my back and ask your mom. And you figure out the kids play those games early on. And mom's typically the softer touch, isn't she? You women know who you are. And that's fine. That's okay. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that. It's not necessarily a failure to be more emotional and softer. I think that's why God made you the way you are. But if you allow that to get in the way, and oh, well, you know. And we learned early on, so we, you know, Linda just told the kids straight out, if you want to do something, go ask Ron. No. No. Because they knew most of the time I was going to say no. Depending on what the deal was. But most of the time they were asking for stuff that was really not appropriate. So I'd say no. I don't want to ask him. But they knew they could get, their instincts were, we can get more from mom than we can with Ron. And that's true in most normal homes, I think. That's not unusual. So the mother has to do this as well. Proverbs 29:15. But again, if the child knows there's two standards of discipline in the home, they're always going to gravitate to the one that won't push them. And that you're just setting them up again for failure. Because that's not going to work out there in the school, and it's not going to work in the job marketplace, and it's not going to work out there. They're not going to play those games. If they're very smart, they won't. The rod and reproof give wisdom. Again, there's verbal instruction coupled with this. Reproof is verbal instruction. Telling the child, you're wrong. And nobody likes being told they're wrong. I had this one guy told me, well, I like it when people tell me I'm wrong. I thought you're an idiot. No, you don't. And secondly, no one does. No, he didn't really like being told he was wrong, in spite of his protestations to the opposite. But a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. And so moms, remember this verse. Guess what? You're going to look bad at the end of the day. Because all parents are going to be evaluated at the bema seat for their parenting too. I mean, every aspect of our Christian life is going to be evaluated, you know. You say, well, I can be weak in this area. No, I wouldn't be. I wouldn't think I could get away with it. You're not above the rules. None of us are. Who brings shame to his mother. And you don't want that. And you can also see Ephesians 6:4. The parents must deal with the problem of the child's sin nature consistently and cannot allow themselves to be deterred by the child's tears. Proverbs 23:13. Again, a child can turn those tears on just the second they know they're in trouble. I've seen it repeatedly. And again, you can see the tears welling up. I haven't even touched you yet. Yeah, but I know it's going to hurt. You bet your ass it's going to hurt. Literally. You just bet with it. You just didn't know it. When you decided to disobey, you were betting with your butt. But that's where we discipline them. And this business of, oh, you can't spank and you can't do this. Well, the state's wrong. The laws are wrong. And this is where a believer can legitimately say, no, I do not have to abide by that. While I will submit to the government, they do not have the right to come in my home and tell me how to raise my children. But our society's caved on this one, hasn't it? Nobody's going to stand up against this. How wrong it is. Do not hold back discipline from the child. Although you strike him with the rod, he will not die. I've never seen anybody die from a good spanking. I mean a normal, disciplined, loving spanking. No, I've never seen a child die from that. Now, obviously children die from abuse, but we live in a society where they're tossing them over bridges, for God's sake. And we're worried about whether or not a child gets spanked and got a little bruise. You know, faithful are the bruises of a friend. You say, well, if you bruised them, that's abuse. No, it's not. It's absolutely not. And I'm not saying you should beat them black and blue. That's not what we're talking about. But I'm saying if you spank them and, I've had, like the willow switch, it drew a little blood from time to time, but it didn't kill me. And, but I sure remembered those switchings. I still remember it, and I'm 60 plus years old. And I still remember Dad telling me, go get a stick off that tree. Oh, Dad, crying on the way home. Because I knew what was coming, and I knew I deserved it. But I was hoping he'd be persuaded by the tears. Well, good parents aren't. They're not persuaded by the tears. They're not deterred by the tears either. So, again, they'll cry. They'll carry on. This isn't fair. Blah, blah, blah. I've heard it all before. And all the other kids, I don't care. All the other kids, I don't raise all the other kids. I raise you. And all the other parents may not care about their kids. I don't care about that either. If they want to let their little kids grow up to be hellions and idiots, I can't stop them. But my job is to make sure you aren't. That's what I'll be judged for. And this one's one I can say pretty much, me and Linda did this one with a clear conscience and did it right. So how they turn out, that's on them. We did right by it, though. And, parents, again, men are basically more strict and stern and disciplinarian types, and women are not so much. I get that. But you got to work together on this, or you'll undermine the whole thing. The parents' first line of instruction and defense against the parents are the first line, rather, of instruction and defense against the sin nature. Failure to fulfill that responsibility brings shame on the parents and discipline on the child. Proverbs 22:15. Again, there's the concept of shame. Here's the one I've cited before. Stupidity is bound up in the heart of a child. It's tied in there. You got to kind of untie it. And guess what unties it? The rod of discipline. Again, there's a connection. We talk about the heart and the rear end. Well, the brain and the rear end, there's a connection there too. Again, this is the rod of discipline. The Board of Education applied to the seat of higher learning can result in great things. And that's how the kids learn, typically. And there's nothing wrong with this. This is in a normal world. So the rod will remove it. Also, 29... Well, I think we've seen 29:15. Let me double check. But I think we saw that. Yeah, a child gets his own way, brings shame to his mother. Correct your son, verse 17, and he will give you comfort. He will also delight your soul. Again, the Proverbs are the normal things. There's always exceptions to these, as we know. But these are the way things normally work in God's plan. But again, even if there are exceptions to this, I'll take my chances with the norm here, that this is the way it works. Parents that will not effectively follow through in this area demonstrate they do not actually love their child. Protest to the contrary, notwithstanding. Again, 13:24. He who withholds the rod hates his son. We've seen that one. And back to 19:18. I think we'd seen that one as well, too. Discipline your son while there is hope. And do not desire his death. The implication is if you don't discipline him, you're desiring his death. You're condemning him, in a sense. This is just the nature of the beast. Normal discipline does not include physical abuse. We have to stress that. Neither does it include oppressing the child with unrealistic expectations or demands. Children can do certain things. Again, you have to tailor this to the age of the child, the level of understanding, the level of culpability, depending on how much they know. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Don't place these unrealistic expectations upon them. You've got to be a little man. I'm only six, for God's sake. I'm not a little man. You know? Real men don't cry. Be tough when you fall. Now, that's not good parenting. You know? You don't want the child to be a little whiny baby either. You got extremes in this. You got to watch out for it. You know? You want to discipline them appropriately. You want to encourage them. But, you know, you don't want them carrying on over every little minor injury. I remember, one day I was playing baseball. The ball took a bad hop. You know, of course, back then we played on the field with rocks and sometimes glass. And how did we survive? You know, you wonder. But the ball took a bad hop and came up, hit me in the eye. And I remember I was crying and carrying on. My dad said, "Okay, that's fine." After a few minutes, he said, "That's enough. You know, but we'll put some ice on it when we get home." I had a black eye for 3 or 4 days. Of course, that's a badge of pride when you're 8. What happened? Oh, bad ground ball. So, physical, you know, unrealistic, trying to live your life through your children, that's another thing. That's unrealistic and stupid. I want them to have everything I never had. That's not a good idea. They're doing fine with having what you had. I never felt deprived as a child, and we weren't rich by any stretch. I mean, you figure whatever a tech sergeant made in the Air Force back in the 60s, and it had 4 boys. I mean, I knew that, you know, we weren't rich. I knew there were other people with more money. I got that. But I never felt neglected. You know, you got 1 new pair of jeans at the beginning of the school year, and that was it. And then after that, they called you patches, because you would have to just iron on patches on them, you know, when you tear them up. So mom would say, "Be careful with these." But when you're an 8-year-old out playing, you don't care. You know, well, they don't mean anything. Well, when you have to buy the jeans, it does mean something. So, again, parents, I watch this, and mothers do this more than dads, although dads are guilty of it too. You know, trying to live their life through, you know, having Tiger out hitting golf balls at 3 to turn him into a star. That's a parent trying to live their life through their kid. And I see that in other, you know, you see this in the gymnastics moms and in the dance moms and this and that. Oh, I want my daughter to be popular and this and that. No. No, that's all the wrong way to go about it. This is not what you should be doing as a parent. You're not there to live your life through them. And I've seen this in parents before. It is just gross. I want my kids to do this and that. I really want to go to the Backstreet Boys, so I'm sending them. Well, I mean, or whoever's popular now. I think that reference is dated. Well, what it does entail is verbal instruction, verbal warnings as to the consequences of disobedience. They have to be instructed first. Discipline isn't first. Instruction is first. And then warnings as their consequence. If you disobey, and the appropriate physical discipline, and the follow-through. You can't threaten things you're not going to do. All you're sending the child the message, well, guess what? Nothing will really happen no matter how much I talk about it. And then they think all authorities are going to be like that. Good authorities aren't. They'll enforce it. And then the appropriate physical discipline for refusal to obey. All right, well, it's about a minute up, so we'll stop there. That's a good part. We'll stop with Category 3 love here and pick up with there on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your plan. May God, the Holy Spirit, enlighten us in Christ's name. Amen.